If you have ever wanted to boo and hiss during a sermon, this is the one. Truly, it's tradition. We get just a bit of Esther's story this morning, but incredibly, it's the only time in the whole lectionary cycle that she shows up at all. Esther, heroine of the Jews in Persia, clever queen, a classic rags-to-riches story. Esther, who wisely arranges for her people's deliverance. This is the story at the center of the Jewish holiday of Purim, a time of revelry and feasting and costumes and carrying on. And reading this story in its entirety twice, generally with great humor and drama and ample adult beverages, and booing. Traditionally, the crowd boos when Haman, the archetypical bad guy, is mentioned. Thank you. The story is unusual in other ways. For one, it's the only book in the Bible where God is not mentioned at all. And yet, it's central to our canon. It's held up in this annual feast for millennia. So, a quick reprise in case any of you are just straining a little bit to remember Esther's story, just in case. Esther is an orphan, and as a Jew in Persia, she is without social status. The king there is rather stupid, and when his wife refuses his demands that she offer indecent party entertainment for his friends, he kicks her out. But then, shoot, that means that he doesn't have a wife. No good. So, cue the inaugural Miss Persia contest, which, incredibly, Esther wins. She's gorgeous, and as we'll soon see, she's very smart. Now, the king's right-hand man, Haman. Oh, you can do better than that. Come on. Yeah, there we go. Haman has some issues. He wants everyone to bow down to him in all his self-importance. And when Mordecai, Esther's uncle, refuses, hey, Trid, oh, you're good. None of you fell for that. That's great. Hatred takes over, and Haman promises revenge. Not only does he plan to hang Mordecai on custom-made 75-foot gallows, he intends to kill the whole Jewish community as well. This guy is not to be messed with. And yet, Esther sees possibility for another path ahead. And at the same time, she wonders if she can really pull it off, wonders what stumbling blocks might stand in her way. One of the most important exchanges of the whole book is left out of our passage this morning. Esther is going around and around with her uncle, trying to decide her way forward. He helps her to see and to own what she already knows. He says to her, "If you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." And so Esther steps forward. With one strategic feast and then another, taking advantage of clever loopholes and wiggle room in the protocol, she moves into the inner ring of power, and she reveals the gory plot of Haman to the king, who in turn agrees to save Mordecai and the Jews, while at the same time sending this, their oppressor, to the monstrous gallows that he himself built. It's not a story of nonviolence, right? To be sure, but for a community long persecuted and living under the oppressor, it has been one of hope, carrying the promise of deliverance, the possibility of freedom. Now, throughout this whole story, we don't hear how God has acted or called or influenced, saved. None of it, no mention. And yet, here's this story, a key part of our sacred texts. How does this brave mischief point us to the divine? How does Esther's example help us to draw closer to the holy? For starters, she shows us how to take charge creatively and reshape the world around. Whatever demons tried to pull her back into fear, into inaction, she pushed them aside. Somehow, Esther is able to hold on to what is true and cast aside that which would make her stumble as she sought her people's deliverance. She holds on to her commitment to her people, her community of the faithful. She remembers who she is, and though we're never told so outright, it seems she also remembers that she is in covenant with God. She remembers to do this work together with others, turning to her uncle Mordecai to support her in discernment as she considers her options, worries about the likely fate of her people, and then is moved to action. And he helps her remember. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Who knows? Maybe you were made for this. Maybe you are just the one we need right now. It is valuable to name God, to pay attention enough to notice the holy moving in what might seem to be unlikely places. And I trust that Esther got there after the dust had settled on this wild adventure. But that kind of explicit naming is not always our starting place. Sometimes, to follow, we have to focus on the path right here, on the stumbling blocks right ahead of us, on the ones we ourselves place there. God is patient and present and can amuse herself while we get our act together. So, what do our stumbling blocks look like? Some maybe look like Esther's or the disciples. Certainly the task of living faithfully immersed in a culture different from our own resonates here in Berkeley. And so does the disciples grappling with who is considered one of us, who's in, who's out. What else gets in our way? Is it the stumbling block of screen time, of flipping through Facebook endlessly, unable to really see or hear what the people right in front of us are saying? Guilty as charged. Maybe it would be easier to lop off my hand, or at least my right thumb, because these little screens, they get in the way of presence, of noticing. I had to laugh last weekend. We were up at the Bishop's Ranch for our parish retreat, a whole bunch of us, and the little screen said, "Connection lost." I was like, no. Or perhaps it's the stumbling block of elevating busyness as a status symbol. How are you? Somebody asks. Busy, crazy busy. I mean, good, but really busy. How often is this our response? True or not, it leaves no room to breathe together, to open space for communion. Because we're already late for something before we've already begun. And what kind of hell is it, really, if we have no time to sit down to eat, or to call back our relatives, or to wrap both hands around our mugs in the morning and sip and notice? Or maybe it's the stumbling block of digging our heels in, so sure that we can do it ourselves, right? Go it alone. And maybe what we need more than anything is to let this body surround us and shore us up and walk with us on the way. So there are blocks, heaps of them, all kinds of them, covering the path ahead, near and far, and sometimes the same ones popping up over and over again, right? And we are to pick up a hammer and a chisel and bring out the wheelbarrow and go to work, chipping away at them, turning them to dust, and hauling them out of the way, off the path. And we are to begin that work now, today. We listen to our Uncle Mordecai calling us out. "What's your stumbling block?" he asks. "Get over yourself and act. Come on, let's go." It's the kind of thing your uncle can say to you in a way that maybe we can't hear it from a parent or a spouse. We can hear it and respond. There is time for Sabbath, and it is good and necessary. And then sometimes we are called to get over our garbage and do the right thing anyway and now. If you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise from another place. Who knows? Perhaps you are here for just such a time as this. We are called for such a time as this always, not some other time in some hoped-for future or some romanticized past, but this time, here and now. We are called for just such a time as this.